through the shimmering surface between two worlds. Standing at the center of time as it uncurls. Cutting through the veil of illusion, moving beyond past conclusions, rendering all my doubt and confusion clear. If I could be anywhere, if I could be anywhere, if I could be anywhere right now, I would want to be here. Searching for the future among the things we're throwing away. Trying to see the world through the junk we produce every day. They say nothing lasts forever, but all the plastic ever made is still here. No amount of closing our eyes will make it disappear. If I could be anywhere, if I could be anywhere, if I could be anywhere in history, I would want to be here. The Romans, the Spanish, the British, the Dutch, American exceptionalism, so out of touch. The folly of empire, repeating its course, imposing its will, ruling by force, on and on through time. Much longer. We're not gonna make it unless we're smarter and stronger. The world's gonna shake itself free of our greed somehow. If I could be anywhere, if I could be anywhere in time, if I could be anywhere and change things, it will have to be now. They say nothing lasts forever, but all the plastic ever made is still here. No amount of closing our eyes will make it disappear. And the world can't take it very much longer. It's not gonna make it. That's we're smarter and stronger. The world's gonna shake itself free of our greed somehow. And the world can't take it, that you can see. If the oceans don't make it, neither will we. The world's gonna shake itself all the way free somehow. If I could be anywhere, if I could be anywhere in time, if I could be anywhere and change the outcome, it would have to be now. Thank you.
As Jackson Browne, if I could be anywhere, I would be here in Canada with a chance to vote the globalist out. Please, Canada, go out. I gotta sound like a broken record, but I don't know. I grew up in Canada, 45, 48 years old almost, or maybe I am 48 now. And yeah, my Canada in the last 5 years just has not been what I expected. G20 being a prime example. And we're going to cover the wedding and connect that up to our G20. We got Charlie Veach making some statements, so... That'll definitely connect us to that Wirra wedding that happened the other day. Don't forget that William and Kate were married on April 29th, the same day that Hitler married Eva Braun. Yeah, the globalists don't miss a chance to thumb their nose with these dates in your face, buddy. Get out and vote for Canada. And it's not the conservatives that you need to vote for. Check out projectdemocracy.ca to align your vote to the correct party. to ensure that anything ABC, anything but conservative, we don't want Harper skating up the middle in any riding. Take a look before you vote on who you need to throw your support to, be it Liberal, NDP, or other. Even the Bloc and some Quebec ridings, there may be a little fight there, I say, between Bloc and NDP, and you don't want the Conservatives skating up the middle. So check out projectdemocracy.ca to align your vote to the correct party to keep the Conservatives out. I'm going to drop this piece on some economics. It gets a little deep here, but that's why I suggest that if you need to download a copy of this program, this will probably be the second hour of my program. It'll be posted at radioforall.net right at the beginning. So if you need to repeat this economic information, you can grab it pretty much within the next 24 hours at radioforall.net. It's also available right now on YouTube, titled Keynes, K-E-Y-N-E-S, Keynes, Crisis and Monopoly Capitalism. And it's by Real News. So I'm going to drop that right now. And it's 18 minutes, 19 minutes long, economic stuff. So get your thinking caps on and listen carefully. Well, we're going to make a big circle here now. From Canada, we're going to cut through U.S. and U.K. and then right back to why you need to get out and vote for anything but conservative. You're listening to Plunder News. My name is Shannon.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Paul Jay. We're at the INET conference in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, the birthplace of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. Now joining us to talk about something that's very much at the heart of the birth of the IMF and also runs through this conference is Keynes, the economic theorist, who we will learn more about because we are now joined by Robert Skidelsky, who has recently just written a book called Return of the Master, Keynes, Return of the Master. Thanks for joining us.
Very happy to be here.
So, first of all, let me ask you, what would Keynes make of what the IMF turned out to be? Because it turned out to be an organization that in much of the world is seen as a force more for destroying national economies than helping them.
Well, that happened later on, and particularly in the East Asian crisis of 1997-1998. I think for a long time the IMF was an organization that helped countries over temporary balance of payments difficulties. That's what it was set up to do. It wasn't his idea, by the way. The IMF was the compromise which he made in the Bretton Woods Agreement. He had a more ambitious plan to set up a world central bank, which would have much more resources, be much better resourced. And the Americans wouldn't actually agree to that because they were providing most of the money and they wanted to have control over the spending of it. So they limited the resources and basically limited the functions of the IMF.
Okay, but just to very quickly remind viewers, this is, we're talking 1944, A conference takes place in the hotel we're in.
In this very hotel.
About what will the post-war world global exchange look like?
Well, it was the end of the war, and people wanted a new world, and they didn't want to go back to the 1930s. And the leaders of the winning coalition said there must be new institutions that could bring order to the world economy and also to the world political system, because the United Nations was also set up as one of these new institutions. But at Bretton Woods, they agreed to set up the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank. They had set up a trade organization. And all these were meant to be pillars of a more stable world order, one that avoided the terrible collapses like 1929, 1932. And also the protectionism that resulted from those collapses and the currency wars of the 1930s when, you know, there was real war, currency war between Britain and the United States, as well as a trade war, and then Germany was in a world of its own.
So what happens? Because as we get into the later decades, IMF starts essentially, what many countries said, is used a kind of blackmail, that if you want the financing, you're going to restructure your economies the way we say. Yeah,
that was the Washington Consensus. That was after the ideological right had taken over in America. This was only after Reagan. It was the new right-wing economics that believed that you mustn't have any as little government as possible, and that the way to prosperity and growth was have balanced budgets, not to have any protection, and to get the government out of the economy. And so all the IMF reconstruction programs, when they appealed to, reflected that ideology. Whereas before, they'd been much more permissive about domestic policies. They hadn't tried to interfere with them. But they saw the light, these new ideologists. There was only one way to get out of poverty and get growth, and that was to get the government out of the markets. And so that was the tenor of their advice.
And what was the consequence?
The consequence was, a couple of decades of 5 years of disaster for East Asia, and very low growth compared to the 1950s and the 1960s. When the IMF was working well, the United States was lending a lot of money abroad, keeping demand very high. Countries were pursuing full employment policies. It was a golden age for Western Europe and for much of the rest of the world. But, you know, the anti-government forces really regained control via the Republican Party, essentially. And then the Clinton Democrats also
were really no different.
Yeah, they weren't that different. And now I'm afraid, as I see it, the Obama presidency has succumbed to this drive to cut and cut and cut government spending as a way to recovery, which is mad, because what you're doing is you're cutting demand, you're cutting spending power, you're cutting it out of the economy, and then you expect people will spend more. It's a simple contradiction in terms.
And on the other side, they're driving down wages. You have in the United States an increasing trend towards what they call two-tier contracts, where new workers are starting at half the wages that they had previously. You have going to have tax on the public sector, where layoffs. So what I don't get is, what is their logic? They're not irrational people, the right. They have some strategy that they think makes sense. What is it?
Well, I mean, I think there are two elements in the strategy. There's first of all, they are ideologically opposed to big government. That is the constant. That's the bottom line. They don't like big government, and they think that if government is smaller, the economy will be larger. Full stop. That goes back to some simplified economic theory, which dates from the Adam Smith and 19th century period. And secondly, they're by no means irrational, because they realize that those policies benefit that very small minority of the population who have most of the money.
And starting point is, we don't want to pay more taxes.
Yes, well, of course, they don't want to pay more taxes, because bigger government means higher taxes. So they want to get taxes reduced. But in order to get taxes reduced and at the same time maintain balanced budgets, you have to cut spending, drastically cut spending. And this seems to be the time to do it, because all governments have been running large deficits in the crisis. And the reason for that is mainly because the economies have shrunk. And when an economy shrinks, the deficit of the government grows automatically. Revenues fall off, and spending for the unemployed and Social Security rises.
I mean, the fact is that the American right, under the Bush administration, they weren't against stimulus, they just don't want to pay for it. They want to pay for it by cutting services that go to the general public. But when we're at this kind of apocalyptic moment, whether it was TARP under Bush or even afterwards, the first beginnings of the Obama reforms were supported by a lot of the Republicans.
Yeah.
They just don't want to pay for the money. They want the rest of the population to pay. So much comes back to this issue of taxes.
Yeah, well, I think they were in favor of the stimulus, because a large part of the stimulus went to bailing out the banks, actually recapitalizing the banks. And they didn't want the banking system to fail, because that meant that they would many of the wealthy people, the investors in the banks, would lose their money. And so they were all in favor of that sort of bailout. And of course, in a way, they when it becomes desperate, they're prepared to abandon their more basic views in order to sort of get things going again. But as soon as the crisis was over, they reverted to the old view, which is that now the government's done its job, it's bailed us out, we can all look forward to nice profits in the banking sector, the stock market has revived again, and now the thing to do, the government's cut its spending. And that's really what I think has driven it. And it's driven it not only in the United States, but in Britain and in Europe as well. Everyone is cutting. And the theory behind the cuts is wrong. One just has to say that again and again, as emphatically as one can. You cannot get a recovery by reducing spending in the economy. You've got to say, where is the offset? Where's the private spending going to come from if you're reducing people's wages, if you're reducing their consumption power?
Now, the people pushing the austerity train have to know that. They're not fools. They have to know what you just said is true. It's just too obvious. So what is their strategy, then?
Well, they have one word: confidence. Once government shows that it can really be as austere and inflict pain, that will revive business confidence. They'll then have the confidence to invest, they'll have the confidence to spend, and really, look at this. Now that they know the deficits are being reduced, they know that taxes won't have to go up in future to pay for the deficits. Therefore, they can spend those bits of taxes they would otherwise have put aside to pay for the deficit when the bill became due. And it's all at that simplified level. Government debt is the same as credit card debt. You've got to pay it back. Wrong. Governments never have to pay back their borrowings. They can go on borrowing. You know, there's no bank manager ringing up Obama saying, "Hey, it's time. You know, you've borrowed all this money. I want your repayments." That person doesn't exist. So governments can go on borrowing. They can go on financing themselves. And the United States government hasn't found no difficulty in financing its deficits. But there is this feeling, you know, simple feeling, you can't live beyond your means, but if you've got to pay back your debt.
Well, the popular notion that's certainly supported in the media and talked about a lot is that eventually this leads to inflation.
Well, not. Well, yes. I mean, inflation is part of a recovery. You know, there's always going to be some inflation. If you have an economy going downhill, prices go down. I mean, you know, the rate of inflation goes down. I mean, there was actually a period when prices were actually going down. It was a short period, and in a recovery, prices go up. But the point is, when there's a lot of unemployment around, a lot of the extra money doesn't go into raising prices, but raising the output of goods. So, you know, that's what when economists talk about a lot of unused capacity, they mean there are lots of people unemployed, there's a lot of plant that's idle, there's a lot of money that's idle, and, you know, that then starts being spent on goods and services.
Well, this is where I have a question about Keynes, which is, and not just Keynes, to some extent it's about many things I'm hearing at the INET conference, which is, you can have various models that make sense, that seem very rational, and there's, you can say, a kind of an aspiration here for a more rational form of capitalism. But politically, you can't pass any of it. Not just in Washington, but in many of the other advanced countries in Europe and Canada, but especially in the United States. There's any number of things that you could talk about: how to have a more green economy, how to have a more full employment objective. You can't even have the discourse here, and I guess what I'm getting at is, if the politics is the factor for paralysis here, because the majority of the American elite, and the elite who actually own stuff, and because they own stuff, they have so much political power, and we know how the relationship of politics here to money, that you got to tackle that.
Yeah.
And that doesn't seem like the discourse or the discussion how to mobilize people outside the elite to tackle that. I'm not hearing that conversation.
No. Well, I think you need two things. First of all, you need an outstanding leader like Roosevelt, who came into office pledging to drive the moneylenders out of the temple. I mean, you know, that was very, very tough language, and he didn't back away from that. He was very, very strong, and he also knew that, you know, he knew what he wanted to do, roughly speaking, and he was determined to drive it through. That's the first thing. The second thing is the situation has to be much worse than it is now. When things are just bumbling along at a not very healthy level, but you know the patient isn't actually on the point of dying, the popular pressure to do something is very, very weak. And the interesting thing is that when the economy is depressed, that actually depresses radicalism quite a lot. People sort of get resigned to the situation, get used to it. You know, people even got used to concentration camps. They made a life out of it. And when people are unemployed, they find a life being unemployed, and when they're underemployed, they adapt. And it's depressed times are not good times for radicalism, actually. Unless they're so bad that there is a revolt of some kind. And I think America in 1932, 1933 was close to sort of saying enough is enough of this. There were big, big demos, big marches, the veterans marched, there were a million people in Washington. They wanted something done, but it was never quite as bad this time.
The issue of who...
Partly because of John Maynard Keynes, who actually was the author of that initial stimulus policy, which stopped the slide.
And also, to some extent, diffused the mass movement.
Yep, yep.
Not necessarily for better in the long run. The issue of who owns stuff, does that not need to be taken on when you have such monopolization, when you have so few people owning, controlling the commanding heights of the economy privately? I thought one of the most interesting moments of this administration, Obama administration, is when they said the only way to really regulate, control, deal with the power of the health industry is through a public option. Now, he caved on it.
Yep.
But he opened a door to a fascinating thing that if it's true for the health sector, why isn't it true for finance sector and some other sectors?
Well, there is a very old tradition, radical tradition in America, known as trust busting. And trust busting was how you dealt with monopoly in the progressive era of the late 19th century, early 20th century. You broke up these monopolies. And you enforced competition. There were two models: either you break them up or you regulate them. And I think that's been the debate over what you do about the banking system. I mean, there are a lot of people who believe that all you need to do, really, to prevent the banking system indulging in the excesses it did in the run-up to the recession, is simply to have better regulation. And the big failure was a failure of regulation. I don't think that goes to the root of the problem, because I think the regulators were captive to the banks, actually. I think you need to break them up. I think some of Obama's initial ideas to limit the capitalization of banks, to break up commercial from investment, separate commercial from investment banking. You know, investment in the commercial banks really became slaves to their investment departments or to the investment banks. I think that separation should have been tackled.
Because what you have now is a situation where neither do you break them up nor do you really regulate them.
Yeah, yeah.
Which goes back to
the
kind of political power of this concentration, this concentrated ownership.
You see, the trust busting thing wasn't just in a narrow economic sense a monopoly. It was a power issue. If you have a lot of concentration of money in a few institutions, that is a power in the country. It's not just a power in the economy, it's a power in politics.
Which was a lot of Eisenhower's argument about the danger of the military-industrial complex.
Yes.
It wasn't just about militarism, so what it does to the politics and democracy of the country.
The irony is that the Democrats hated Eisenhower because he thought he wasn't doing, you know, proper Keynesian stuff. In fact, it's now a golden age, Eisenhower. I mean, it turns out he was a very enlightened liberal. He raised money for the state highway system. He did masses of infrastructure, Eisenhower. But he wasn't rhetorically, at any rate, he wasn't a Keynesian.
Well, in the next segment of our interview, let's talk about a solution you're proposing, a national development bank. So please join us for the next segment of this interview on the Real News Network.
All right, you're listening to Plunder News. My name is Shannon. There you go, some deep economic thinking, but of course, very right-on stuff if you listen to it again. I had to listen to it two or three times, really, before I got it all. And right-on stuff. Jack Layton could do well by following the advice in this piece right here from Real News Network called Keynes, Crisis and Monopoly Capitalism. All right, so you can find that on YouTube right now, and I'll be posting my copy to YouTube later. You can also catch my show on radioforall.net, the whole 2 hours. It'll be broken in two parts, and this will be the beginning of the second part. So within the next 24 hours, I'll have it up there under Plunder News, CKLN.fm, at radioforall.net for podcast or MP3 downloads, and YouTube will be coming up within 48 to maybe even 64 hours because sometimes it takes a little longer to get the visuals up. Okay, Plunder News, it's 10:07. Frequency Feminism is coming up at 10:30. We're going to get right now into the royal wedding stuff, because I see it as all being very connected to our election, the Queen being a figurehead in Canada, and we're going to be covering some of those issues too, so watch out for that. But right now we're going to just jump into some facts here about who's paying for the election and the economics of that, and austerity, which we just talked about. So just without further ado, let's run, jump it in, get it going. Yeah.
Begun to the UK royal wedding. Prince William and Kate Middleton will tie the knot on Friday. It is widely believed that British taxpayers rather than the royal family will pay for the lavish $48 million wedding at London's Westminster Abbey. Meanwhile, April 29th has been declared a national holiday to mark the occasion. The move is estimated to cost Britain about $10 billion. Britons already pay some £40 million a year to maintain their royal family. A precise evaluation of Queen Elizabeth II's assets is impossible due to the secrecy surrounding her personal business empire. However, it is estimated that the Queen's private wealth places the octogenarian among the five richest monarchs in the world. The following are among Queen Elizabeth II's royal powers. The Queen is the head and source of all branches of public power. The Queen is head of the British Armed Forces. She can exercise personal discretion over issues such as appointing the Prime Minister and can dissolve Parliament. And the Queen is the only person to declare war and peace. It is claimed that the Queen's authorities are nominal. However, Britain, Canada and Australia's military involvement in the US-led invasion of Iraq, as well as the UK's refusal to join a treaty banning cluster bombs, are among decisions approved by the Queen. The April 29th royal extravaganza comes at a time of worsening economic conditions in Britain. It is reminiscent of the Queen's marriage to Prince Philip in 1947, which came against a backdrop of food rationing and post-World War II weariness. Britain is grappling with a massive budget shortfall. More than 2.5 million Britons are unemployed. The government has taken austerity measures in an attempt to contain the country's huge budget deficit, and that has already sparked violent protests nationwide.
Numbers.
Meanwhile, a recent poll shows Britons are far less excited about William and Kate's wedding than the extensive flattery of media coverage suggests. The poll commissioned by the campaign group Republic has shown that almost 80% of people simply don't care about the so-called big day. Also based on the poll, 1 in 3 people believe the BBC's coverage is biased in favour of the royals. Some believe the government is using the royal wedding relief to distract Britons from their economic woes. And pro-democracy voices wonder how it is possible for a country that claims to be a promoter of democratic principles to advertise hereditary monarchy in the third millennium, a country many believe has been behind the establishment of the autocratic regimes that people are rising up against in the Middle East.
The United States was founded on July 4th, 1776, in resistance to the hegemonic, despotic, tyrannical rule of King George III and the abuse against the colonies. And most of the British Parliament was against going to war with their fellow Englishmen because the king was unpopular there as well. It was known that he was a German king, his father being brought over to rule England. These people could barely speak English. Nothing against Germans, but you don't see me going over to Germany to rule them. The very essence of July 4th and 1776 is resistance to the disgusting House of Windsor. They didn't get that name until around World War I, because before that they were known as the Saxe-Coburg-Gothas. Notice that we hear their names. Prince William. You never hear his last name, do you? The slave public, many of them in England, who support these people, don't even know their last names because they don't want you knowing their last names. 3 times in the last 3 years, the Parliament in Canada hasn't done what the Queen of England wants, so she suspended them, shut down the Parliament. Happened in the late 70s in Australia. This is a tyrannical group pushing eugenics, population reduction, all the carbon taxes. Prince Philip, the Queen's husband, another German royal prince, is a supporter of eugenics. His cousin, who was the prince married to the Queen of the Netherlands, unadmitted Nazi, unadmitted eugenicist. The point is, these are the most filthy, degenerate people you can imagine. She owns more than half of Canada, more than half the land in England, and then she's paid by the government for her palaces and all the rest of it. It's disgusting. And to watch U.S. television fawning, Fox, CNN, CBS, all of them. Oh, it's so wonderful. No one in America can wait until next week. The way they're hyping it.
1 week until the royal wedding. This is exciting stuff. I mean, it's hard to, I mean, the energy is just palpable.
Young couples get married, they're just hoping that some bank will be nice enough to give them a mortgage.
Yeah.
These folks have a number of palaces to pick from.
NBC News is launching a free royal wedding app for the iPad.
This is truly a love story that captures everybody's attention.
This goes back to Edward Bernays 100 years ago saying, look, to make politicians and royalty popular, we'll have Hollywood stars come to banquets and events with them. We'll have music stars. We'll have other people go there to basically make these elites be seen as celebrities themselves. You know why America was founded? Because under the imperial royal system in Europe and England, if you weren't part of the inside group who had basically the patronage of the crown, where they gave you land, houses, jobs, you couldn't even get a license to be a carpenter, a license to be a blacksmith, a license to brew beer, unless their local lords gave you the authorization. So it wasn't just that you had to pay outrageous taxes. You had to get their permission to even have a job, to have a profession. Ladies and gentlemen, that's the essence of globalism, is big mega corporations, many of which are owned and controlled by the German royal family that runs England and, of course, the Netherlands. The whole system they've set up and they promote is about this new global corporate system worldwide that, through government power, shuts down their competition and transfers the people's wealth through taxes to the offshore cartels. These people are parasites. They're disgusting. They're filthy. And if we want to reclaim the spirit of 1776, we should realize how abhorrent monarchy is in all of its forms. And that includes the UN and the new royalty under the unelected EU bureaucratic system, where over 80% of England's laws, even though they're not part of the EU, are made by EU bureaucrats. please, everyone, remember the spirit of 1776. I know a lot of folks in England are saying they're going to go out and protest it. First, the government said you've got the day off slaves. You don't have to go to work on the big royal wedding coming up next week. And then the Republicans, that's a group that want to get rid of the monarchy in England, said we're going to protest in the streets. And the government said you're not allowed to protest. Meanwhile, they criticize Syria for banning protest. So anytime you see some mind-numb zombie talking about how exciting the wedding is or how they watched it, you're watching a bunch of twitly, inbred idiots that can't even dress themselves and have valets. And until just a few decades ago, they try to keep it quiet. They have people that wipe their butts for them, groom of the stool. Do you know the history of America? Do you know it started in resistance to this very usurping German family who aren't even British? Do you know that most of the English hate the royal family? Do you know they have a secret police system that basically threatens people that talk about getting rid of the monarchy? Do you know that Princess Diana on record told her butler and others and made a videotape saying Prince Charles has threatened me, he's going to kill me in a fake auto accident? These people are absolutely anathema. And the servile folks that have been raised to worship these people and all the little old ladies that think it's cute, well, that's why we're enslaved. That's why our country's bankrupt. That's why we're going to hell in a handbasket. Because you've forgotten what it is to be an American. Or perhaps you were never even taught. But now you're going to learn what it's like to be a subject, a slave. What is royalty? Royalty is Kim Jong-il in North Korea. His father took over and then gave him power, and now he's giving power to his son. Why don't they just put gold crowns on their heads and dress up with long flowing robes? Maybe then Americans would celebrate the royal wedding of Kim Jong-il's son. Oh, but they wear little military uniforms and we know how clownish it is. But somehow we've been tricked that wearing big gold crowns and flowing robes isn't more ridiculous and stupid. America has been great because it's not about what race you are or what family pedigree or how murderous your great-granddaddy was. It's about what you individually can do. It's about what you individually have to offer, being an inventor, a trailblazer, an explorer, someone who's brave, an artist, someone who has incredible literature in their soul. These royal, crony capitalist, non-free market systems always wage war against the individual. They always wage war against the productive. And the British royal family are at the head of pushing world population reduction. They are at the head of one-child policies. They are at the head of eugenics. They taught the Nazis everything they knew about eugenics. Do you understand this is mainline history? The King of England had to abdicate at the beginning of World War II because he wanted to merge with Hitler.
The British royal family come from a long line of dictators. They're oppressive. They're anti-liberty and freedom. And here it is, all over the British and world news today, the outrage that dictators from oppressive Middle Eastern and African countries are coming, a whole gaggle of them, to the royal wedding. It's disgusting. It's a bunch of hereditary gangsters meeting, laughing at how they've tricked the public to worship their tyranny and think it's cute and funny and fashionable.
So down with the royals. Down with the Saxe-Coburg-Gothas and their fake house name Windsor and their New World Order trying to retake North America. The planet's waking up and the corporate barons, the UN barons, the unelected bureaucracy, the new royalty backed up by the old royalty are going down. We redeclare the spirit of 1776 against you and your ilk. You're on notice.
From his small bedroom in Cambridge, Charlie Veitch is planning to cause havoc at the royal wedding. A committed anarchist who set up a group called the Love Police, Mr. Veitch believes it's an ideal opportunity to spread their anti-state message. But he says they won't use or condone violence, just words and megaphones.
We use a very deep irony, incredible sarcasm. We almost, in a way, promote the very opposite of which we're trying to say, which makes people think. It creates a cognitive dissonance in people's brains. So, for example, in the royal wedding, we will probably shout out messages such as, worship the Blue Bloods. Here come the Blue Bloods. They're better than you.
A former bank worker himself, Mr. Veitch is now a veteran of demonstrations targeting financial and other corporate institutions. He says he's been arrested many times but never convicted. His group of around 500 activists specializes in absurd chants and slogans. He knows his actions will anger the hundreds of thousands of royalists in London to celebrate the wedding. But he has no qualms about trying to cause as much chaos as possible in front of Prince William and Kate Middleton. Today, the Metropolitan Police were showing the media some of the security measures which will be in place in and around Westminster Abbey before and on April the 29th.
I'm sure many people in this country would take a very dim view of people coming to London and wanting to engage in criminal behaviour, and they have our absolute reassurance that the Metropolitan Police Service is ready to act quickly and decisively should that happen.
The pro-monarchy English Defence League, which has a power base in Luton, has promised to confront opposition groups. That could increase the likelihood of violence. But groups like the Love Police say they won't be intimidated into silence.
If in the year 2011 I would be put off by spreading a political anarchist message for fear of violent retaliation, then I would be a coward. I stand by my convictions.
It's possible measures could be taken to prevent known activists like Mr. Veitch from travelling to London. If that happens, he says he'll drop out of sight, then re-emerge somewhere along the royal route. Matthew Hudson, Anglia News, in Cambridge.
Yeah, and those measures were put in place a few days before the wedding. Secret law was passed, or maybe not so secret law. The law was changed to accommodate Charlie Veitch's detention for approximately 24 hours. He sat in a cell while the wedding took place. Him and about 100 other like-minded activists, or assorted similar-minded activists anyway, were arrested under a provisional law put in place simply for keeping the streets clear of anarchists and assorted other type of activities that may draw attention away from the little display of opulence and, well, it's been covered. This is Plunder News. My name is Shannon. I don't need to make this stuff up. I don't even need to say it. It's out there and it's real. Shannon Reiner, Plundering the News on CKLN.fm each and every Sunday morning, 8:30 till 10:30 now. And, we got one more little piece here. This is a post-wedding piece from Charlie Veitch, and then we'll be out of here. Till next week, do look for copies of this program posted at radioforall.net. I'm going to possibly get something on rabble.ca. It's a good source out there. Take a look at rabbles.ca, but radioforall.net right now for copies of this show. Each and every week, the last few weeks, I've been putting them up now, and we got three weeks in a row covering the Canadian election, so there's over at least 5 hours of Canadian election coverage. And you can also catch this show posted at YouTube. These segments, the better parts, will be posted on YouTube. Again, under the search word Plunder News. And we have lots of material there as well. So do check those sources out. Otherwise, stay listening to CKLN.fm in Toronto as we broadcast live 24 hours, 7 days a week in defiance of CRTC decision. What was it? Can't remember the number. Anyway, CRTC decision to cancel our license, broadcasting license. Well, we're still here. It's just a little harder to get us. You can't get us on the radio. You have to look for us now. Okay, one more piece here from Charlie Veitch, and we're out of here. This is Plunder News. Shannon Reiner signing off. Till next week.
Well, the anarchist history is basically that the royal family are still the head of the British Parliament. We live in a constitutional monarchy, and you may think that the Queen has no power, but every soldier swears allegiance to the Queen before he goes and kills Arab men for democracy.
I would
so
never
have a monarchy spreading democracy. Every policeman has the Queen's crown on his helmet. Whenever you go to a courthouse, there's the big emblem of the Queen on the wall of the royal family. And when I was in the police station yesterday, I was charged by the Crown Prosecution Service. So it's permeating all of British society. So for anyone to say that the royal family has no power, just needs to look at these China-style pre-crime arrests of anyone with a dissenting opinion to truly see the fake state of liberty in Great Britain. There is no real liberty here. As long as you toe the line, you'll be fine. I have no problem with two young people in love wanting to get married. But when they spend my taxpayers' money and all the other people's taxpayers' money, it becomes a propaganda problem. And it's not an issue that we can escape the royal wedding. Every single house, all my neighbors, got flags and pictures of William and Kate. It's turning into an almost North Korean personality cult, and it's very scary.
What that sounds like this, Obama, what, if you ask me.
Yeah, no kidding. So what do you think this says about the people of England?
It says that they have a long way to go before they can actually psychologically mature as sovereign adults and throw off their psychological shackles of oppression and devotion to a parasite, elitist, blue-blooded family that thinks of them as scumbags.
Okay, I'm converted.
Look into the long view. Tell us about that.
Well, I'll give you some love. The police that actually came to arrest me, the detectives that interviewed me, they were very polite, very fair. They treated me with utmost respect. I think what happened with me in the pre-crime arrest with the other 100 people is a massive public relations victory for the resistance, because in all the middle class media, all the kind of nice high class newspapers and on the BBC, people are getting very agitated that the state is coming after peaceful people now, and this helps wake up the masses that perhaps the state is trying to hide something, that they're trying to maybe sell an agenda. So arrests like mine yesterday, I feel very positive about that, and it helps me spread my message. It's brought me an extra 1,000 subscribers overnight. London Police is now a household name in Great Britain, so thank you, media.
Excellent. Well, congratulations on the boon that this has for your activism, because...
Yeah.